As to accusing me of believing in a world without states, I happily express guilt on that account. I do travel a lot, and I always lose my passport, so I have a self-interest in disposing of states.
Professor Finkelstein, I'm sure what you're saying is that Israel can't survive if there's peace. It requires constant fear, this constant threat, in order to gain the support of the United States. And without the support of the United States, there wouldn't be an Israel.
No, I don't think it's true. You know, there have been many militarized states in history, can't say ours is much of an exception. States which like to create hysterias about various threats in order to militarize society. Ours is not an exception. And there were states which were very militarized, states like Germany from 1871 to the end of the Nazi era. They managed to survive very well after the back of German racism and militarism was broken during World War II. So I don't think there's any reason to infer that Israel couldn't exist at peace with its neighbors. There's nothing inevitable about the constant conflicts. Though one has to add that there are deep features in Israeli society such that it will be a very difficult struggle for it to normalize. And the features get uglier as time passes. And it has to be said that those militaristic features, are greatly exacerbated by two factors. Number one, the immunity that Israel has managed to acquire by its exploitation of the Nazi Holocaust. And number two, the absolutely wretched role that has been played by American Jewish organizations in encouraging the ugliest features of Israeli society, and frankly, pointing ultimately to Israel's destruction. That's what they're doing. That's, I think, fairly obvious at this point. The good thing is, and it's hard to speak about anything good coming out of a massacre. I'm a coward by nature. I don't say that in order to get people to deny it, but it's just a fact. And I cling to life and my every breath. So when I see 400 children whose lives have been snuffed out, for what? I can't talk about who won and who lost. That's sort of like maybe military people can do that, but it's not part of my framework, my moral or mental framework. I just see vast destruction and death, at least at the first level. My mind slipped. So I can't say, I won't talk about who won or lost the war, but it is true, I think, that this Gaza massacre will probably be remembered as the equivalent in the Israel-Palestine conflict of the Sharpeville massacre in South Africa. It was a moral turning point. Now, Sharpeville was not yet Soweto, but it marked a main turning point in the world's perception of South Africa. And what happened in Gaza marked a major turning point, I think, in the world's perception of Israel, which has become, frankly, a satanic state. And we should be honest about that. It just is relentlessly relentlessly embarking on war after war after war. And nobody should be saying that gleefully. It's not a happy thing to behold. But as I said, the silver lining in a very dark cloud, it's clear that even American Jewry, leaving aside Americans writ large, even American Jewry is now beginning to significantly distance itself from Israel, especially in the 40s and under generation, most of you in this room. It was clear during the massacre, for example, on the liberal blogs, the liberal bloggers, the Huffington Post, Salon.com, sentiment was totally against Israel. And as one blogger put it, I think it was Glenn Greenwald or Max Blumenthal, he said the only one now among American Jewry left supporting Israel, he said, is what he called the Geritol generation. Now, most of you who are young in this room won't know what that means. There was a famous medicine in the 1950s called the Geritol, and the commercial went, take Geritol and sleep, sleep, safe and restful, sleep, sleep, sleep. It was a factor, the U.S. election. I think there was some concern in Israel that the new U.S. president would be open to negotiating with Iran, which was a real problem for the Israelis, because the Israeli strategy is you're supposed to bomb them. That's Israel's notion of diplomacy. And there was also a concern that there may be some openings with Hamas, so they wanted to radicalize Hamas before the election results came in. But in general, there's very little grounds for any optimism from the new president, the new U.S. president. Right after he came to office, he made a statement in the State Department. I guess it was his second day in office. And he said many, many wretched things. Time doesn't allow me but to go through it. But one was just pretty striking. I mentioned to you that March 2002 Arab League peace proposal. And the peace proposal basically contained three components. One, two states in the June 67 border. Two, a just resolution of the refugee question. And three, the Arab League threw in something new. It was so desperate to try to finally resolve this conflict, it said to Israel, if you agree to these terms, we will engage in normal relations with you. That is to say, economic trade, tourism, and so forth. That was a new element, plainly contingent on Israel doing what it was obligated to do, to fully withdraw to the June 67 border. So what does Barack Obama do? He makes his statement and he says as follows. The Arab Peace Initiative contains constructive elements that could help advance these peace efforts. Now is the time for Arab states to act on the initiative's promise by taking steps towards normalizing relations with Israel. Well, that was weird. He completely eliminated the Israeli responsibility under the initiative to withdraw. The only thing he said is that the Arabs should fulfill their side of the obligation, but Israel has no obligation to fulfill its side. So he turned a peace initiative into an instrument for surrender. And that's likely what's going to continue.
Hi, I have a two-part question. The first is, I saw recently a piece that 60 Minutes did that was quite brilliant, I think, exposing Israeli policies directed towards Palestinians. And one of the words that they used to describe what was happening to Palestine was apartheid. And of course, have received the requisite hate mail for doing so. Relatedly, Naomi Klein has recently come out in support of a boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign against the state of Israel as well. And so I'm just wondering, one, if you can describe why Israel, you talk about Sharpsville, but if you could describe why Israel, it is accurate to describe Israel as an apartheid state. And secondly, what do you think about the prospects for actually organizing a divestment campaign against the state of Israel?
Well, the first and most obvious point is, in the real world, there's nothing controversial about describing Israeli policies in the occupied territories as apartheid. In Haaretz, Israel's most respected newspaper, many of its editorials refer to Israeli apartheid practices in the occupied territories. Israel's main human rights organization defending the rights of Palestinians, Bet Selem, it refers to Israeli apartheid policies, the apartheid road system in the occupied territories. Even the centrist, the liberal centrist Israeli organizations like ACRI, the Civil Rights in Israel, the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, in its last publication, has an annual publication. It says Israel's creating an apartheid-like system in the occupied territories. And the list goes on and on. There's nothing nowadays, there's nothing particularly controversial, as there was nothing controversial when Jimmy Carter used the title in his book for those who, you know, attach some significance to the real world and lesser significance to the New York Times. As to the prospects for, you know, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, obviously in principle there can't be anything against boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Those are nonviolent means of trying to achieve a just end. That's not problematic. The problems arise in who you're going to boycott, where are you going to divest, and who are you going to sanction. And there, things can sometimes get complicated. The one that's had the most controversy swirling around it has obviously been the academic boycott and the claim that boycotting Israeli academics conflicts with the principle of academic freedom. And, you know, there are arguments to be made. I'm not dogmatic on these issues. I could see the arguments on both sides. On the other hand, maybe this is a little bit glib on my part, and I'll acknowledge that it's not the most precise of answers, but the occupation has now been enduring for more than 40 years. And if an academic boycott could facilitate in a significant way ending the occupation, then in principle I can see a reason to oppose it. An academic boycott is not the end of the world. It means some Israeli scholars won't be able to get visiting professorships in the United States. Some Israeli scholars won't be able to get positions, temporary positions at Oxford or Cambridge. I'm not saying it's nothing. And I'm not saying that issues arise. You can admit there are issues of academic freedom that arise. But there you then have to make an unbalanced judgment. And for me, the unbalanced judgment is, after 40 years, anything which is consistent with basic principles of decency, which can for once and for all put an end to that horrific occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, I think it's reasonable.
Thank you for coming. Well, last night, anticipating coming here today, I was unable to go to sleep, so I turned on the TV and I was watching a movie, 1966, with Michael Douglas and Frank. you've seen him.
No, but I know Frank Sinatra. I don't know how many of you know him. I know.
Well, the first time I've seen it was about the 1948 and everything, but it was very, very one-sided, which was just obvious, you know, just to decide. What I want to know is there was a poll in Israel, like you said, 90%.
About 90, yeah.
About 90%. For what you attribute that, you know, if you want to elaborate on that.
No, I'm no expert in Israeli society, and there are people here, there are Israelis in the audience, friends of mine, and maybe even Professor Perlman will be more knowledgeable. I think, as I said, I think that there are, you know, the problems that come with a society which began as a settler society, kind of like our American West, built on trying to annihilate the indigenous population. You know, if some of you ever pick up Theodore Roosevelt's The Winning of the West, it's a very ugly show there. I mean, the guy sounds like Hitler times 10 when you read The Winning of the West and how he depicts the native population. And Israel is just coming out of, and not thoroughly out of, that period of settlement of Palestine. So there's that kind of settler mentality, and then the settler mentality is then exacerbated by all the worst features of European imperialism in the Arab world, and then it's exacerbated by a society which has enjoyed just remarkable immunity from international criticism, despite these flagrant and egregious violations of basic principles of international law. So let's just take what happened in Gaza. These European leaders, they go to Mubarak, they go to Olmert, they huddle, they debate, they discuss. And what do they debate and discuss? How are we going to end the arms smuggling to Hamas? That's a very curious scene. Israel broke the ceasefire. Israel committed the massacre. And what do these European leaders huddle around? How we should prevent the victim from getting weapons, not how to prevent weapons from going to Israel, which broke the ceasefire uncontroversially, which committed a massacre uncontroversially. I mean, it was so uncontroversial that Secretary General Ban Ki-moon returned from the dead. He actually said something. I mean, I think most of the world didn't even know who was the Attorney General. Most people probably still think it's Kofi Annan. I mean, it was so horrendous what was done that even he expressed outrage. And these European governments tried to figure out how to further disarm Hamas. The only possible inference being that a 100-to-1 kill ratio was insufficient for these exemplars of Western civilization. The kill ratio should have been 1,300-0. They had too many arms, Hamas.
Wrap up around 7 o'clock. So maybe we'll take a couple of questions. I'll remember them.
Okay.
Let's take a few just to wrap things up. I was wondering why you changed the title of your speech, and I understand that it was the issue of the massacre.
Mm-hmm.
But I personally believe that Gandhi's words are stronger now than before the massacre. Because even though this talks about what Palestine did to what Israel did to Palestine, Hamas is a terrorist organization. And they did shoot rockets into Israel. No one's going to deny that. And what, rather than focusing just on all the problems that Israel has done, I think we need to actually focus on a way to solve the problem which doesn't mean you have to use terrorism. And Gandhi was the man in the best way. He defeated the British Empire with almost no resources.
Let's take a couple more questions.
Two things. One, which you raised the question of immunity that Israel has had under the word Holocaust, which it seems to me that actually this time around, as you mentioned, that it's actually starting to wear off.
Correct.
If anything, the question of Gaza and Warsaw Ghetto in the minds of people.
Totally agree.
If you could comment on that in terms of how this time around it's different. Which I think that actually connects to the question of the possibility of actually raising the divestment issue this time around, given that the state of Illinois actually just bought $6 million in Israel bonds. I think that part of that's part of the discussion of what we can do on campuses around here. So if you can comment on what is different this time around and what is the opportunity given with everything that the hope that's been raised also in terms of the change in the U.S. elections too.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the first question, I don't think you would think Gandhi was the man if you read his works and not just seen how he's depicted in Hollywood, because Gandhi was pretty tough on these questions. It's totally untrue that Gandhi was a categorical opponent of violence. People don't know the real Gandhi, and had I delivered the lecture I intended, I would have gone through what he's actually written on the subject. But rather than speak in generalities, we can speak in specifics, because the first great uprising of the indigenous population of Palestine to the British mandate and the Zionist colonization occurred between 1936 and 39. It's called the Great Arab Revolt. And Gandhi was already, as you know, in that era, he was a major political actor, and this was another component of the British Empire. One component is obviously the jewel in the crown, India, but Palestine is a second component. And Gandhi was asked to comment on what was going on in Gaza, what was going on in Palestine, namely the revolt. And it was a very violent revolt. His position was very clear. He said, had I had my way, I would want them to use nonviolence. But he said, and I'm quoting him verbatim, according to the accepted canons of right and wrong, nothing can be said against the Arab use of violence against their occupiers. He was very clear about that. And you would be surprised how tough he was, you know, during World War II. There was a lot of hypocrisy in Gandhi, a lot of inconsistency. A great man, I have no doubt. If I wore a hat, it would be I'd doff my hat to the Mahatma. He was a great man. It's not just the illusions of Hollywood. But there was a lot of inconsistency in him. But during World War II, you know, the British played the same game as the Israelis now play. For those of you who know the history of India, they would say, we can't leave India. Who are we supposed to give power to? There is the Congress Party, and then there is the Muslim League, Jinnah, and then there are the princely states. Who are we supposed to give it to? And now Israel plays the same dirty game. Hamas, Fatah, civil war, who are we supposed to give power to? And Gandhi's answer was very simple. It was very emphatic. He says, it's none of your business what goes on in India. You know? He said, you have only one obligation, that is, to take your bags and leave. If we have a civil war, he said, hey, many countries have passed through civil wars. They survived, we'll survive. I'm hopeful we won't have a civil war there, he was mistaken. But if we do, you know, countries pass through it. But you have no right to use that as grounds for being here. You have no right to be here. You have only one right: pack your bags and leave. And the same principle applies to Israel and the West Bank and Gaza. Oh, just on the question, the second question that was asked, I basically agree with him. The Holocaust card has been exhausted. People are just, rightfully in my opinion, sick and tired of hearing it. It's been just cheapened by overuse. It's the equivalent, the Holocaust is now, it's the equivalent of a shmata. For those of you who don't know Yiddish, shmata means a rag, what you use to dust, clean your car, wipe your hands from the grease. My hands are full of grease, I need a shmata. And that's what the Holocaust is. It's just a shmata. You're lecturing me. You're lecturing me.
Okay, great, excellent. I am neither Jewish nor Arab, and really the Jews only represent 2% of American population, or a little bit more, and the Arabs only represent 3% of the Jewish American and Arab American. So being neither one of those, and just being an American citizen, I just do not understand why our news organizations and our leaders keep saying that Israel is such a good ally of ours. I don't see what the rest of us, American citizens, are getting for our constant support of this hyper-aggressive military government.
Well, I would just amend that statement by saying Jews and Arabs also are getting very little from what Israel is doing. So we all have as a factual matter, and not to be a crowd pleaser, which I'm not by nature, I don't think Israelis gain very much from what Israel does, and it's simply on the path to destruction if it continues on this route. So we all have a common interest in finally settling the conflict.
Mr. Finkelstein, you and the University of Chicago Professor John Hersheimer have both been very vocally critical of Israel in the past few years. Yet, I feel like at some point there's kind of a divergence where Hersheimer on the realist camp would argue that what you call a massacre is in fact still warfare, whether it's 13,000 to zero or 100 to one, especially in the definition set out by Karl von Clausewitz on war. So how would you respond as a realist argument that Israel still, as a sovereign state, has the right to go about and do what they want with the police?
Well, an argument of that sort is the equivalent of saying, Germany had a real Jewish problem. There's no question about that. There were many Germans who didn't like Jews, and it caused for a lot of tension and antagonism in German society. And so now the Jewish problem has been eliminated, has been solved in Germany. So using your realist argument, there is a good argument to be made to be pro-extermination of Jews. Do rational, moral agents in the real world, do they use that logic? Are they so devoid of an ethical sense that they use the kind of logic that says, however many are killed, if it, quote, works in the end, then it's okay? Okay, Germany no longer has a Jewish problem. I just think that kind of argument is sick, and I know Professor Mearsheimer reasonably well. I couldn't possibly believe he subscribes to that kind of insanity.
Unfortunately, I think we've already pushed past our time limit, so we're going to have to close it with that. So thank you very much.